Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Gordon Grigg. He enjoyed a career as an academic zoologist who managed to spend a lot of time working in the field. Apart from interest in crocodilians that go back to 1971, he studied thermoregulatory biology of free-ranging echidnas and platypus in Australia's high country and flew aerial surveys of kangaroo populations for nearly 30 years. His PhD came from a study of fish biology at the University of Oregon. He then had 20 years on the academic staff at the University of Sydney, followed by 20 years at the University of Queensland, where he's now an emeritus professor, a well-balanced career. His primary research interests are in vertebrate zoology, particularly their physiology, ecology, and evolution. He's co-authored about 200 peer-reviewed publications, about one quarter of which are on crocodilians. So first, thank you for your work, and second, thank you for being on the program.
Thanks, Derek. I'm pleased to be.
So how and why did you first get interested in crocodilians?
Well, like so many good things in life, it happened quite accidentally. I'd come back fairly freshly from the United States with a PhD, having worked on fish, but I had an interest in vertebrate biology in general, particularly what sorts of onboard equipment, physiological equipment and behavioral equipment, vertebrates carry that enables them to live in, you know, whatever habitat they occur in. And quite by chance, an opportunity arose to work on crocodiles in northern Australia because a physicist of all people wanted to radio track crocodiles in northern Australia using radio telemetry. This is long before the days of the of satellite tracking and things like this. This is in 1971. And so all of a sudden I had an opportunity to work on the enigmatic huge reptiles that the crocodilians are, because the focus was to be on the largest of all of them, the saltwater crocodile, Crocodilus porosus, and it's that species that most of my experience has been on. And really on the first field trips, I fell in love with them and was just so intrigued by all of the interesting things about them. To be driving up a river, northern Australia, one of these sinuous rivers that flows across the floodplains in northern Australia, remote habitat, very few communities, and the only communities are very small, isolated communities. So at night you don't see anybody. Of course, you go out at night to see them because their eyes shine in the dark, and you have a team of three people, usually somebody driving the boat, somebody on a spotlight, and somebody with whatever catching equipment you're using for the night. And just the whole beauty of that scenario in such wilderness was really provocative. And one of the things that I think is particularly interesting as I look back on that time 45 years ago, I realized that in fact the way we used to catch the small crocodiles then is something we'd never contemplate doing now, because at that time there were very few large animals left. They'd been very severely hunted, and as a result of protection, which came in at about that time, they'd been hunted for skins, of course. But about that time, the early 1970s, they became protected. And since then, there's been a magnificent recovery across northern Australia, so that they're now quite secure, at least for the time being, as far as we can see to the future. But the way we used to catch them then was somebody, the third person in the boat, would be wearing a wetsuit, which makes you feel quite brave, of course. And we'd come in slowly on a crocodile up to about 5 feet long, and the person wearing the wetsuit would jump out of the boat with their hands out in front of them and their thumbs locked and drop onto the crocodile's neck and hold it free of the water, and then usually just be in the bank. The boat would go aground on the mud bank or the muddy edge of the river and near the mangroves, and of course we'd have our crocodile secured and go off looking for another. So it's a very exciting introduction to working on what I've come to realise is such a spectacular, well, one example of a very spectacular group of organisms, which I've come to understand and really appreciate them for what they are. Still lots of mysteries about them and some recent discoveries. Really a great critter to have had the opportunity to work on.
So, before we go on, I just wanted to comment that you skipped very quickly from jumping out of the boat and grabbing a crocodile to going on to find another. That it sounds like that would actually be, I don't know whether the word I want to use is thrilling or scary.
I think satisfying, really, because we were catching the animals because we wanted to do some physiological research on them. And it was also part of a study on population ecology, so they're being marked. And so we'd work maybe catching 6, 8, 10, or 12 animals on a really good night. And it was very satisfying to be able to be out in such beautiful surroundings with people that you doing field work with, people that you work well with and trust. And it wasn't really scary because we didn't think of it as particularly dangerous. As I said, I wouldn't do that now because those animals, those populations have recovered to such an extent that you'd be worried that there'd be a big crocodile lurking nearby. It would be very ill-advised to be catching them that way nowadays.
You know, that's also, before we go on, that also makes me think of something about how I think that what we are used to and what we know, oftentimes we find less scary than the things we don't know. Because I live in, where I live, I see bears every single day, and I walk through the forest, and oftentimes the bears are fairly close to me, and they don't scare me at all. But when I talk to other people who don't live in bear territory, they get very scared of the bears. And having not grown up around them and not experienced any of the crocodilians up close, they seem more foreign and scary. But once again, if I say this about bears or any other of the animals that live near me, then it's just, oh, that's a wonderful part of life in this forest.
Yes, I agree, absolutely. That's when you understand something and you know what you're up against, it's a lot more realistic. I mean, certainly if a crocodile started charging me, that would be very frightening. I'd be very scared. But in our field work, we avoid those sorts of situations because we have a reasonable understanding, I suppose, of what's safe and what's not safe. And certainly we didn't ever see ourselves as big, tough, strong heroes or anything like that. We were just behaving sensibly around some animals that certainly do have the capacity to be very dangerous, but they're not. They're presented as animals which are man-eaters, which they are, and a lot of people get taken by one crocodilian or another. In Africa, a lot of people are taken by Nile crocodiles every year because they bathe in the water and get their water supply from rivers, many of them, and some of them more, you know, away from the towns, out around the countryside. And in South America, the American crocodile, which is now making a big recovery in Florida, that's a common. Every year there are a few deaths from American crocodiles in, Costa Rica is one of the places. So they're certainly dangerous animals, there's no doubt about that. But at the same time, they shouldn't be thought of as animals which are always out to get you, because humans aren't really part of their normal diet. And I can think of lots of examples where we know there are crocodiles around and people are swimming and whatever. And we know from radio tracking data, for example, that crocodiles might, well, there's a very interesting study published recently showing that a place which is quite frequently visited by Aboriginal people for fishing and swimming, it's a sort of a river crossing, and the crocodiles, there are often crocodiles in the pools on one or other side of this crossing, and they're waiting for the tide to come up or for it to be night so they can continue on their way, either up or down the river. But nobody's been taken at that crossing quite frequently while there are humans there enjoying themselves and relaxing, fishing and swimming. The crocodiles aren't taking any notice of them. So it's not right to think that crocodiles are always on the hunt for human beings.
I'm really glad you said that, and I feel a bit sheepish for having said what I did about that sounding scary, because you know there's so much propaganda that once again that non-humans are always out to get us. There is that sort of mythology that pervades this culture quite a lot. But whenever people talk to me about bears that way, I always point out that there is about one human dies in North America every 2 years from a bear attack, as opposed to, for example, 30,000 people die every year in car wrecks, you know, and so we get scared of the wrong thing. So let's go on. And you've said that, well, first off, let's define crocodilians. Who are they? When you say that, what do you mean?
Well, they're a group of survivors. Well, think of dinosaurs. I think probably most people know that dinosaurs are archosaurs. And the birds are descended from dinosaurs, or birds are, in fact, modern dinosaurs. So if you sort of imagine an evolutionary tree, you've got the dinosaurs leading on to the birds on one half of it. And on the other half of it, you've got all of the crocodilians and their ancestral tree, and they are also archosaurs. So they fit as reptiles, as sort of cousins of the dinosaurs. They're not dinosaurs, but they have a common ancestry with the dinosaurs and the birds as archosaurs. And they're very different from the reptiles from most of the other reptiles that are around today, things like snakes and lizards. They came off the evolutionary stem much earlier than the archosaurs. So they're a very different sort of critter. And their evolutionary history is in geological time, they were as diverse as the dinosaurs were. And a lot more of them survived the end of the big extinction that happened at the end of the Mesozoic about 65 million years ago. More of them survived that extinction than groups of dinosaurs. But out of the hundreds of species of known crocodiles and their kin, we've only got today about 27 species described, but a couple more probably going to be described as geneticists examine some populations and find that they can be split. But we've only got perhaps 30 or fewer separate species surviving. And I think we're very lucky to have them, because most of the crocodiliforms, if we can use that word to describe that type of critter, most of them didn't survive to modern times. And I think our world is a lot richer because we have these, and of course there's a practical reason for it too, apart from just appreciating from what they are. The practical reason is that because of their common ancestry with the dinosaurs, they have all sorts of, it's reasonable for people who are trying to speculate about what the biology of the dinosaurs might have been. They can look in one direction, of course, to the birds, lay eggs and have maternal care and things like that, but they can also look to the crocodilians and see what they do. And of course, the crocodilians also lay eggs, and they're the only reptiles that also have maternal care. They've got very elaborate behaviour, elaborate sociality. They look after their young. They help their young hatch from the eggs, just the way birds do. So that's an archosaur characteristic. So that I think that the dinosaur people trying to study dinosaur biology can probably learn quite a lot by looking pretty carefully at crocodilians are doing, the modern crocodilians, and so that's a sort of a practical reason why we're particularly lucky to have crocodilians still surviving.
So crocodilians are in southern North America, they're in South America, Africa, Australia. Where else are they?
Oh, well, in Southeast Asia, there are, of the sort of 27 or so species, there are about a third of them are the Alligatorids, a big family, the Alligatoridae, and that's the two, well, six species of caiman that live in South America, caiman crocodilus, and a whole bunch of others, some of which are a lot smaller than the big crocodiles. And of course, in North America, you've got a very successful recovery of the American alligators. There are two species of alligators. There's another one, and that lives in China. And that's a real puzzle because nobody can. Well, there are certainly hypotheses, but no totally satisfying explanation how these two species, how there can be a species in China, the Chinese alligator, which is its population is so disjunct from the American alligator, because unlike the crocodiles, and there are about 17 species of crocodiles, they all have sock glands on their tongues, and some of them are still able to use those sock glands. When I say still, I mean in an evolutionary sense, they're still able to use those sock glands to travel across oceans. And so it's easy to understand that the 17 species of crocodilians occur all around the Earth, really, in tropical and subtropical regions. But the alligators are restricted mainly to South America and North America, except for this. Without sock glands, they don't have the capacity to cross oceans. And yet you've got this one outlying species up in China. So it probably must have got there across the Bering Straits when sea levels were lower. But, of course, it's pretty cold and it's a bit hard to see how that happened. But who knows? It's good to have some puzzles still for us to chew over.
So I guess a couple questions. One of them is that you talked about raising their children, and you talked about, I believe you said, sociology. And can you talk a little bit about the rearing of the young for people who don't know, and then also talk about social relations in the crocodilians? I know nothing about that. Can you educate me about those?
Well, a little bit. There's still a lot not known, but it's been known for a long time that let's talk about the maternal care and start with that perhaps. One of the real controversies for a long time, when I first got interested in crocodiles, there was still controversial. There were stories about mother crocodiles going and digging up some of them nest in holes and some build a mound, but alligators or crocodiles or whatever, it's a generalization that applies to the group, that the young would call from they make a squawking call when they're hatching, and the parent, usually the mother, would come and assist them getting out of the nest, and then pick them up in the mouth and carry them to the water and release them and make repeated trips until they'd collected all of the 20 or 30 little baby hatchling crocs or alligators, carry them down to the water. And that was controversial even still in the early 1970s, but it's now well established and well known. It's been documented a number of species, so it applies to them all. And then once they're in the water, they'll stay together. The hatchlings will stay together and form what's known as a creche. and the mother will stay with them. Different species are a bit different. Some of them will stay with the young for even a year or more and provide some sort of protection, or it's thought that's the case. The actual data to support that it increases their survival doesn't really exist, but I think it's a fair enough assumption that this, that there is a method behind that apparent madness. Some of them are in the creche for only a few weeks. So that's a pretty well-developed sense of maternal care. And sometimes the male will do it will do the same thing. So with the squawking of the young, that's a very bird-like behaviour. But they have a whole lot of other, as far as the general socialisation is concerned, sociality, they have all sorts of capacities for communicating. They can communicate acoustically by calling to each other. Many of your listeners probably will have been to places where they would see or know about, they would know about alligators in a community of male alligators calling, bellowing in synchrony round when courtship is starting. And they all, perhaps it may be less well known, that they've also got a great capacity for generating sound that is too low for human hearing. So like elephants, they rely a lot on infrasound for communicating, particularly underwater and across quite long distances, so that the infrasound clearly plays a role. And it's certainly known that that they can respond to it. What the language of infrasound conveys isn't properly understood yet, but it's probably sexually stimulating. There's some reasonably good evidence for that. There's also good evidence that one alligator or crocodile can probably pick up the direction from which the infrasound is coming, the source of or the mechanism by which that sound is judged is a bit uncertain. I might say something about that later on. So there's this whole sort of behaviour which is apparently quite advanced, really, in terms of its socialisation. They're not shouldn't be thought of as individuals which spend their whole life alone. Many of them are alone for much of the time, but when they're in breeding seasons and so on, they can come together. And it's also known, for example, in South America, there's some very nice data which shows that they will travel between water holes, what Australians would call billabongs. I'm not sure is water hole a good name to use for water. If you've got, for example, in the Brazilian Pantanal, the water in the dry season will get lower and lower until there's only water in pools, in water holes. And some very nice data describing how when conditions get lower, when the water level gets low, they'll all leave a large number of caiman will leave the water and travel as a small herd, a group, often in single file, and go off and find another water hole. So there's quite a lot of group behaviour. And I should also mention a concept which is growing up and becoming and warrants a lot of additional study, the concept of there being a boss croc. In Australia, this is work or discussion that's emerging in Australia, in northern Australia, where when the water levels go down at the end of the wet season, often populations will be in particular billabongs, and a billabong might have 100 or more adult and subadult crocs in it. But often there's one particular animal which is large and is a sort of a dominant male, which has come to be known as the boss croc. There's still a lot more to learn about what role he plays, but the hypotheses are that he plays a role protecting females and even, chasing sub-adult males away that might be harassing females. And that's something that'll be interesting for some behaviourists to look at in future years. They've also got, not complex, but a whole bunch of body language signalling that they understand. For example, if an animal wants to show another animal that it's not a threat, it can lift the head just in the water, just lift the snout, and that'll be taken as a sign of submission. Or how high, if it's in a high float position, by taking more air into its lungs, it can ride higher in the water. And that's a message to say, I'm tougher than you are, mate. Don't mess with me. Whereas if it goes low in the water, as not hard to understand, clearly it's saying, I'm not any threat to you. Just let me be on my way. And this is particularly important in, say, in a river, which is a long linear or semi-linear type habitat, where the animals have to move through each other territories. Through each other's territory, they've got an opportunity to be able to signal their passive intention and go through a dominant male croc's territory. So there are all sorts of social behaviour, I suppose, which is fascinating.
Yeah, I think that's
it. And it helps. I think as you come to understand it, it really endears them to you when you realise that they're not just stupid things that are trying to take a bite of your leg.
Yeah, it's no matter what we're talking about, whether it's sharks or rivers or salmon or crocodilians, it's just the more I learn about the real world, the more extraordinary and fascinating and wonderful it all is.
Yeah, well, there are a couple of others. I was going to talk about infrasound a little bit.
Great.
That made me think about these integumentary. There are some recent discoveries that I think it's worth mentioning. I'd like to just mention three of them quickly, if
Great.
I may. And that is, one of them was 2002, a lady called Daphne Suarez discovered part, anyway, of the function of these little dots that occur on the scales of the heads of both crocodiles and alligators. Now, I better describe what these are. On the heads of crocs and alligators are these tiny little dome-shaped buttons, I guess you could call them, usually with a bit of pigment, so they're darker than the scale. But not necessarily. You have to look quite closely. And she found that if she had a crocodile in a tank and she dropped something into the water, even though it was dark, the animal's head would immediately swing towards that as if it was seeing a potential of something to eat. Well, a lot more work's been done on these now, and they're called integumentary sense organs. And they every scale in the head has multiple of these ISOs, integumentary sense organs, abbreviated to ISOs. And it turns out that they're multi-function organs in terms of what they can sense. And they are very sensitive to vibrations. They're very sensitive to touch. They're as sensitive as the sense organs in human fingertips. And clearly they play a major role in understanding food items. Don't forget, crocs and alligators have their eyes on top of their head. So when they've got something in their mouth, they can't necessarily see much of it, but it helps them manipulate food. So they're very sensitive around the mouth to be gauging aspects of the prey item before they swallow it. And very sensitive to vibrations in the water. It's even possible that they're some of the sense organs that are receiving information about the direction from which an infrasound signal is coming. So that's part of the story. But it gets, that all sounds great. I mean, they're chemosensory as well, touch receptors, vibrationary sensors, and pressure receptors. That's all great. But one of the real puzzles, and for the life of me, I can't think why it is, crocodiles and alligators both have these ISOs all over their heads. This is a unique sense organ to crocodilians, by the way. It's not known in any other group of organisms. The crocodiles have them on every scale of the body, all the down the fingers, down the toes, every scale on the tail, all over the back. Every scale, have a close look, and it's got a little integumentary sense organ. Alligators don't have them except on the head. They're naked. They're naked of integumentary sense organs. And it's a huge puzzle to me. You'd think, what are alligators missing out on? Because if you imagine a crocodile in the water, sitting, and everybody will be familiar with this pose, a croc sitting in the water, almost all of it is underwater. It's got its, can have its nostrils sticking up so it can sense, got a good sense of smell. It's got its eyes above the surface of the water. It's got its ears at the surface so it can see what all the things that are going on above water quite easily. But below water, there's not much, except for these ISOs. And crocodiles have got the ISOs all over the body so they can feel or sense fish, for example, swimming around. And that might be, and also when they're on the bottom, when they're diving, they've got the capacity to sense prey, not just from their head, but from the body in general, in turbid water, for example, when their sense of vision mightn't be much use. So it's a fascinating sense organ. Information about this is developed from a discovery and published in 2002. It's really only in the last 3 or 4 years that there's been a series of papers, publications, which are starting to really dissect them and work out what they can do. Every one of them has a lot of nerves going to it. The whole face of a crocodile or an alligator is a network of the trigeminal nerve, so that the nerve is there studying what these ISOs are doing. It's a very interesting area, I reckon, anyway. And that's one of the recent discoveries that I think is pretty interesting. Do you want me to tell you about another one?
Yeah, I just want to comment on that one, that it sounds, yeah, that feels to me, and let me know if this is wrong, you know, when we hear that dogs can smell, well, this is even more so. I was going to say, you know, we know that dogs can smell like 300 times better than we can, and bears can smell, yeah, like 10 or 100 times better than dogs can. So the world, their perception is so different, and this feels like that to me, except it's even more so since it's an entirely different sense. It's rather than a stronger sense of smell or something, or a stronger,
yeah,
sense of feeling, it's an entirely different feeling.
Yes, I don't know. They use them in courtship. When crocodilians court, they're really very gentle and tender in their courtship, and they spend a lot of time together, often touching each other rubbing their faces and heads together, and a lot of the attention is given to their areas where these sense organs are more densely placed. So, and I've seen the large saltwater crocodiles, I've seen a mating of them, and when the male was pursuing the female, who was playing hard to get, by the way, swimming away and then waiting and swimming away and then waiting, but as the male was chasing her, he was letting out bursts of infrasound. You could see his flanks trembling and sending up a jet of water to the sides. And I imagine that this infrasound going out probably provides some sort of a frisson of excitement, perhaps to certainly let her know what his intentions are. Let's see, we've got a bit off the track, haven't we? I'm sorry about that.
No, it's great. So what's the second thing?
Oh, well, I suppose the other thing that's interesting to mention is that there's been quite a lot of, well, not a hell of a lot, but there's been some data accumulating now of monitoring their movement by satellite tracking. This was the monitoring their movements was the reason that I got involved, because of a professor of physics wanting to radio track crocs in northern Australia. Well, now the technology is available to do that properly and well, and there's a lot of data accumulating monitoring the movement of animals using satellite technology. And what's emerging is that really they travel a lot, and some of there are journeys of several hundred kilometres made. I was involved in the edge of one project where an animal moved 200 or 300 kilometres down the west coast of Cape York, which is on the northeast corner of Australia, the pointy bit that sticks up. Went a couple of hundred kilometres down the coast, stayed there for a while, and then went all the way back up the coast again to the same place. And so that, of course, raises questions about how well they, or how much of the country they know, whether and how well they can navigate. And some animals have been translocated. Another study that I was involved with, animals were translocated up and down the coast, and they all went back to the place where they'd been captured after a little while. And one of them was a really spectacular example. An animal was moved from the west coast of Cape York, slung under a helicopter, and moved about 150 kilometres across Cape York. As I say, that's the pointy bit that sticks up at the top of Queensland. And it stayed, this was in August, and it stayed there for a few months, making small journeys, but not going far away from where it was released. And then in December, it suddenly started moving purposefully northward up the east coast and got to into the Torres Strait, which separates Cape York from Papua New Guinea, and continued around the Cape and down the west side of Cape York, and went up and went into the same river where it had been captured. And it made that journey 400 kilometres in 20 days. So it was travelling 20 kilometres a day. What's that in miles? That's about 12 miles, yeah, 12 or so miles. So that's a pretty good journey. It may have been a bit current assisted, but obviously it would have stayed, it had stayed close to the coast, so it can't rely totally. So it's quite an active activity. And you really wonder how it knew, or whether it knew where it was going, or if it was somehow able to work out where it was and which way to go home. A combination of, I suppose, as it got close, it would have recognised familiar area, but it does raise questions about navigation. And it is known that sea turtles have got magnetoreception capacities. They can sense the Earth's magnetic field, and I suspect that crocodilians can as well. so humans can't, but humans don't have a lagena in our ear. Our ear doesn't have a lagena. No mammals do, but reptiles do, and birds do. And the lagena is one of the organs that is suggested might be the sense organ which is responding to, the Earth's magnetic field. So it, so this sort of, what I'm talking about is speculative, but of course that's the way people learn about things. They come up with ideas and suggest what might be possible, what might be going on, and then it's up to them or somebody else to examine it and, reject it if it doesn't fit the, pattern, doesn't fit the observations, and look for something else. So certainly that, to my way of thinking, the most encouraging hypothesis is that they're sensing the Earth's magnetic field. And there was even one very simple experiment which a guy in South America did. He was a local wildlife fellow, a ranger, who was forever being asked to take crocodiles away from an area where they were bothering people. So he'd take them a few miles away, and he did this several times, and they kept coming back. So just off his own bat, and I don't know what prompted him to think about this, he took some magnets out of car horns and taped them onto the head of the animals, and then after that, other problem animals, when he got more requests to move an animal, he'd tape these magnets onto the head, take them a few miles away and let them go, and none of them came back. Now, not a well-controlled experiment, but it's quite a provocative observation, which I think needs to be looked at again, and I think it does support in makes you really think that we ought to be looking more carefully at magnetic perception in, crocodilians. They're a very competent group of critters, and if you have a lot to do with them, I think you can't help gaining an enormous admiration for them.
Well, I think so far, I mean, you've done, I think listeners are going to gain some of this, as much admiration as you can get from a distance. From this, so we have about 5 minutes left, and you said there were three interesting things. Sorry, you can choose any of these or all these, whatever you want to do. You said there were three interesting things you wanted to mention. So there's that. There's also, what roles do crocodilians play in their natural communities? I'm thinking, like when wolves came back into Yellowstone, that actually improved trout habitat because the wolves would cause the elk to leave the to not eat all the young bushes near the streams, and so there were these ramifying effects. So when the crocodiles, for example, have flourished again in northern Australia, what positive effects has that had on the larger community? And then the third question, I know there's a lot in 5 minutes. The third question is, how does their future look? So any one of those or more of those that you want to talk about?
Okay, well, I really wish that we had data that was convincing about the role, hopefully a positive role, that crocodilians play in the ecosystem. Certainly they're a top predator in the one of the top predators in the marine environment in northern Australia, in the case of saltwater crocodiles, and in wetland systems throughout the world, wherever there are crocodiles or alligators, they'll be taking a lot of fish and so on. There's a dearth of really good information about what role they play in terms of, we need more before and after studies. It would have been a wonderful opportunity in the 1970s to get a lot more data about the marine and freshwater ecosystems before the recovery of the saltwater crocodiles happened. I wish I had a good answer which would support the belief that people have that if the crocodiles are conserved and allowed to put back in habitat, this is going to make the habitat more healthy. I think it's partly that belief partly stems from this notion that about the sort of the balance of nature, which of course is an ever-changing balance and not something that's quite as fixed as people often say. As far as their future's concerned, that's intimately connected with our own future. We know from lots of, well, two things, I guess, to be quick. We know that wherever a lot of agriculture gets going, habitat alienation will essentially remove the crocodiles or alligators. The Chinese alligator that I mentioned earlier are essentially extinct in the wild. They're very numerous in captivity, but in the wild they're essentially extinct, and that's as a result of their wetland habitats having been given over to agriculture just from the sheer number of people who are using the habitat for that source. So that's one thing we know. High density of human activity will get rid of crocs and alligators. The second thing is that we also know from the experience with saltwater crocodiles, they were diminished to very, very low numbers in Australia by hunting post-World War II for their hides. Once they were protected, the numbers have come back very well. And so we know that if they're left to their own devices and there are suitable habitat for them, crocodile and alligator populations can recover. The American alligator provides another example of that. But in Southeast Asia, saltwater crocodiles are being excluded progressively by the increase in agricultural activity. So the threats that they have are agricultural activity and hunting, whether it's for food or subsistence or even commercial harvesting for meat. And in West Africa, that's a real problem at the moment. Some of the least understood crocodilians live in West Africa, and they're under heavy pressure from being hunted for food, mainly for food rather than leather. So the future is all tied up with ours. I suppose in our presently unsustainable world, where our present situation with our current civilizations using the world's resources unsustainably, you'd have to say that with a third of, or with about a half of the current crocodilians already, well, nine of them are critically endangered. The 13 are endangered or critically endangered or vulnerable. You'd have to say that the future of those is all bleak. The remainder, some of them are very numerous. Caimans in South America, some species there are very numerous. American alligators, saltwater crocodiles in northern Australia are very numerous. But if the human population continues to spread and occupy every bit of the wetland habitats, we'd have to be thinking that in the long term there won't be many places left for that'll be places where a crocodile or an alligator can be a crocodile or an alligator. And I hope that doesn't happen. Hopefully we'll come to our senses sometime along the way, and crocs and alligators and a lot of other of the biodiversity might survive.
Well, thank you so much, and I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Gordon Griggs. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.